It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're wrapping up the first week of our new show and our reorganized statewide networks, WPR News and WPR Music. You're listening now to WPR News. And if you're looking for the music service, head over to WPR.org/new for full schedules and signals.
On WPR.org, you can also listen anytime to the music service or this here network, WPR News. Stay with us on Wisconsin Today for the next hour, and thanks for joining us. Now, Wisconsin has entered the cryptocurrency market. The State of Wisconsin Investment Board purchased more than $160 million of shares in Bitcoin exchange-traded funds. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation this week outlining a new framework for regulating digital currencies.
We learn more about Wisconsin's investment in cryptocurrency and implications for the state's pension fund. Paul Nylon is an assistant professor of taxation at UW-Whitewater and faculty director of its Blockchain and Cryptocurrency Institute. Paul, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So here, Bitcoin.com says our state is the first in the U.S. to buy shares of Bitcoin. Is this a significant moment?
Yeah, it's a great moment. I think, you know, it's historical in the context of Wisconsin being one of the first states. I also think it's significant because, in my opinion, it shows the investment board did their homework, and the people who do their homework generally find that Bitcoin is a really great long-term investment.
How did this investment board do its homework? What did it get right here?
So the board could have, Bitcoin's been around for a while, so it's not like they could have only got into the asset class, you know, within the last 6 months. But essentially what happened in January was the SEC approved a Bitcoin ETF. And so what this allowed pension funds and other investment boards to do was to let somebody else actually custody Bitcoin and have that that fund like BlackRock or Fidelity issue shares so that the investment board could buy the shares of a fraction of Bitcoin as opposed to actually holding their own keys in Bitcoin itself. So I think the board... you look at the timing, they bought it kind of early spring, late winter, which I think was great. And the fact they went and they diversified a little bit. So they bought some BlackRock shares and some Grayscale shares, which I think is fine. But yeah, all in all, I think it was a great move.
And SEC Securities and Exchange Commission. So here's the State of Wisconsin Investment Board buying shares of a Bitcoin exchange traded fund. So how does our state buying shares of an ETF differ from buying Bitcoin directly?
Oh man, okay, that's a fantastic question. So in Bitcoin, there's this phrase that's you'll sometimes hear, not your keys, not your coins. And unfortunately, I think for a lot of Bitcoin's history, there have been very poor custodians. So if you think about FTX and Mt. Gox and all these sort of famous news stories, and these were companies located in the Cayman Islands or someplace like that, who eventually lost their Bitcoin keys or did something fraudulent on their customers' behalf. What we have now is name brand institutions, right? So Fidelity, Bitwise, BlackRock, and they're the ones who actually hold the keys to the Bitcoin. Bitcoin's a bearer asset, so whoever holds the private keys actually has the ability to move that Bitcoin. So the state of Wisconsin is trusting, you know, a third party here, but investment boards have to do that. They can't, you know, bring all their own gold into their own office, and they can't, you know, physically hold their Apple shares. They need a third party, Charles Schwab, somebody like that to do that. So There is a difference. There, you know, I don't see a way in which a big state like Wisconsin or, other pension funds would actually custody their own Bitcoin. They would let a BlackRock or a Fidelity do that. And so I think given that circumstance, it's a great solution for Wisconsin.
I wonder then, did you see any movement in Bitcoin's price with Wisconsin's buy here? I mean, how could a Bitcoin ETF impact Bitcoin's price?
Yeah, so I'll caveat to say that anyone who tries to predict the sort of day-to-day price of Bitcoin is a fool's errand. Long-term, we know it's a great investment. Short-term, very volatile. What you saw back in January when the ETF was approved, Bitcoin was trading at somewhere in the $40,000 range, and now it's closer to high 60s, low 70s. What makes Bitcoin, one of the many great things about Bitcoin is it has a fixed supply. And so unlike a lot of these other cryptocurrencies like that have no cap or no known supply like Ethereum, we know Bitcoin's cap is 21 million. It's hard coded into the protocol. And so when a big buyer like Wisconsin comes in, it is buying, albeit a small percentage of that share, it's buying a small fraction of that 21 million. And so over time, as the demand for that number goes up, it's going to force the price to go up even higher. And so I suspect as more pension funds get involved, as more large companies start buying Bitcoin, you'll see a continued upward pressure on price.
We're talking about Wisconsin's pension fund investing in Bitcoin with Paul Nyland, assistant professor at UW-Whitewater, faculty director of its Blockchain and Cryptocurrency Institute. Paul, you mentioned volatility and shares of Bitcoin can be extremely volatile. 2021, the price of one Bitcoin reached nearly $66,000, dropped to around $16,000 2022. Then this year, we see a new high of about $71,000 in that neighborhood. Why is the state buying shares of something that is so volatile?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's another great question. And the volatility, which you have to remember, long-term, the volatility is your friend. If you want assets that are completely non-volatile, your best bet is to just buy cash and keep the cash at your house. Unfortunately, if you
under
do that—
Under the mattress?
Under the mattress, yeah, yeah. but if you go back to like 2019, for example, you know, if you take your cash and stick it underneath your mattress, think about all the normal stuff you would have bought in 2019 and you buy today. Your spending power is significantly less with something like cash, which is, you know, quote, stable. So the volatility is your friend long term. Obviously, short term, you know, if you're looking at it, you know, a sort of year to year thing, a 2 year time span, I would say going all in on Bitcoin and then, you know, hoping in 2 years it goes up, bad idea. But one thing I should mention is that over the past 5 years, 10 years, and 15 years, Bitcoin is the best performing asset class of all the major assets. So that's real estate, the S&P 500, other commodities. You can get burned in the short term with the volatility, but longer term, 5, 10, and 15 years, it's a fantastic investment opportunity.
There is other hand-wringing here. I mean, the Department of Homeland Security says cryptocurrencies have been linked to money laundering, to cybercrime, consumer scams. There was the report by the U.S. Energy Information Administration saying that the world's crypto miners used as much electricity as all of Australia last year. I mean, should our state be financially invested in an asset with these issues?
Yeah, so another great question. One thing I think would be great for your listeners to know. So as you mentioned in my introduction, so one thing I do is I teach at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and we write exams for students that we try to write an exam to figure out exactly how many hours they studied. And oftentimes what I tell people is if you study enough and then conclude that Bitcoin is, you know, used for terrorism or takes too much energy or something like that, what you're telling me is you just didn't quite study enough. Not you personally, Kate, but I think the people, because it's very easy to sort of peruse headlines and think, oh, it's going to use, the energy's bad, all this stuff. And I think just to sort of talk about a couple of these here, you know, the best use case for terrorism is probably still like a bag of cash, untraceable. Bitcoin operates on a blockchain. It's actually the worst thing to use for, you know, illicit activities because everything's trackable. And then the other point I'll just make about the energy argument is a really fascinating one. And there's a couple different books that have been written about this, but one book that I really like to recommend to people, there's a book called A Progressive's Case for Bitcoin by Jason Mayer. And he talks about all these different things, the energy use being one of them. And the thing I'd probably leave your listeners with is once you kind of go down this rabbit hole, I think what you actually find is the energy use is a feature, not a bug of Bitcoin. It allows people to get into the market with a real world cost. This is different than like Ethereum or some other coins where these are proof of stake coins where they're just created out of thin air, right? They're a set of developers who press a button and they double the supply. Bitcoin, if you want to be part of the Bitcoin network, you have to provide real-world energy. It's called the proof of work system. And when you really dive into it, it's the most ethical system because it's not tied to geography or politics or corporations or a specific labor party. It's just tied to energy. So you want to be part of the network. You tie it to energy. Energy's located all over the world. So we don't have to worry about, are we favoriting, you know, one country over another? It's the energy is divided relatively evenly over the world. So it's a very sort of ethical protocol.
Well, let's turn to current events and to Capitol Hill to get your take on the House passing legislation creating this new framework for how federal agencies would regulate cryptocurrency. We heard the CEO of the Crypto Council for Innovation calling this vote a defining moment. Would this new regulatory approach be good for Wisconsin?
I think so. Yeah. So the current regular, the best way to think about this is to ask, what is the current regulatory approach? And the current approach is nothing short of a mess. There's been lawsuits going on with the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, for over a decade. This is really doing is help provide some clarity about which administrative bodies are in charge of cryptocurrencies. Mm. And so I think any clarity at this point is probably good clarity.
Okay. And so should then the State of Wisconsin Investment Board hang on to these new assets? When would they sell their shares of Bitcoin?
Yeah, great question. I'm actually going to go a step further. I think Wisconsin's a little underinvested. Wisconsin's put about a little, well, less than 1% of the fund in there. I think, you know, a 1% to 3% allocation is probably where a lot of these boards are headed. Hmm. I realize everyone just wants to dip their toe in. But Bitcoin is a long duration asset. So in my opinion, it's the last thing you sell.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Paul Nyland, Assistant Professor of Taxation, UW-Whitewater, Faculty Director of its Blockchain and Cryptocurrency Institute. And for disclosure, employees of WPR are participants in the Wisconsin retirement system.
Coming up, recovery from a gunshot wound can be a long and difficult process, and the wounds can be emotional and mental, as well as physical.
When we meet with our patients, we talk about not only is it important to recover physically, but there's a significant emotional impact of surviving firearm violence.
The unique Milwaukee Project aims to help survivors rebuild their lives. Find out more on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. There were over 800 non-fatal shootings in Milwaukee last year, according to police data. That's despite the city seeing a 4% drop in non-fatal shootings from the year before.
But what happens to survivors of gun violence in the days and weeks after their injury?
In 2020, Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin opened a clinic that aims to offer help beyond the immediate treatment of physical wounds, including post-traumatic stress disorder. New research on the clinic makes the case that the program is working.
We learn about the Wisconsin Trauma Quality of Life Clinic in Milwaukee, its approach to helping survivors of gun violence, and why they're calling for other trauma centers to follow in their footsteps.
Terry Darun Cassini is a psychologist and director of the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and Colleen Trevino is director of the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic and a nurse practitioner and assistant professor in the Division of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Colleen, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having us.
And Terry, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. We're excited to be here.
Now, Colleen, we might think of course, if somebody suffers a gunshot wound, they're going to go to the emergency room. They're going to have surgery to deal with that immediate physical concern. You do a lot more than that initial physical care. What kind of treatment, big picture, do survivors receive in this clinic?
This is a really innovative multidisciplinary clinic that doesn't exist outside of Milwaukee. Dr. Darun Cassini and I have been talking about ensuring the appropriate care of patients holistically for a very long time. And we were able to put this this clinic together to address all of the needs after a gunshot wound. And so in that clinic, we have myself, who is the medical provider, look at the wounds, address the pain, make sure that they have additional follow-up care with the specialists. And then we have Dr. Jeroen Cassini as the clinical psychologist who addresses their mental health needs. We have a social worker who can provide resources for food and housing and transportation. And then we have a physical therapist who will reevaluate them and determine if they need further rehab needs. And then we also have our 4-4 life violence hospital-based violence interrupters who are also in clinic who address safety and concerns for retaliation as well.
Terry, let's dig into those mental health needs that Colleen just mentioned. Screenings at your clinic found nearly 80% of patients were at risk for post-traumatic stress disorder after a gunshot injury, nearly half at risk for depression. Can you talk a little bit about the mental health struggles involved with surviving gun violence?
When we meet with our patients, we talk about not only is it important to recover physically, but there's a significant emotional impact of surviving firearm violence. And it's, I liken it to, you know, we have part of our brain that's responsible for helping us to understand situations that are, should be deemed fearful. And what happens in situations like a life-threatening event is that part of our brain kind of goes on overdrive. And it kind of, it's almost like having an alarm system for the White House, 24/7, 360-degree surveillance, constantly checking, noticing noises that before somebody wouldn't be noticing, but all of a sudden they are now startling. Also picking up on movement that before they wouldn't have picked up on. And that leads people to want to avoid people and places and situations, which then really isolates people. And then in turn, they're not establishing or reestablishing positive pro-social connections with other people. And therefore, it also affects their mood, where they're starting to feel down or sad or depressed. And not only is the potential, the shooting itself potentially traumatic and have impact for people, but also the physical injuries and the physical limitations that people have. We have our trauma quality of life clinic today, and we have a patient who was has facial injuries, and that patient has significant visual changes to the point where, you know, they cannot function the same that they did on a daily basis before the shooting. And so sometimes there can be an emotional adjustment to also the physical changes that happen after going through a firearm related injury. And so our job is to work with individuals, identify who's at risk for developing long-term distress after something like this, and to intervene early to try to prevent that longer-term distress. Because we know that once something like PTSD becomes chronic or depression becomes chronic, it's even harder to treat. And so we're really trying to prevent the development of those chronic conditions.
And Colleen, both of you have mentioned chronic pain after a gunshot wound. If we have only seen gunshot wounds in action movies, we might see our hero get shot in scene one and they're up and about and fine in scene two and scene three. What is the reality when it comes to longer term chronic pain?
What we do see a lot more is that when you have a gunshot wound, it's a high velocity bullet, which not only destroys the immediate tissue, but also causes a blast injury. And so what it can do is disrupt the nerves. And we see a lot of neuropathic pain, which is the most difficult type of pain to be able to control. Opioids don't manage it well. So there's lots of different other medications that have to be utilized. And the key, once again, is to try to prevent the development of chronic pain. So we have to be very aggressive initially to be able to treat that pain, know what type of pain it is, and then provide the appropriate types of medication for that specialized pain.
And Terry, chronic pain can be depressing, and depression can lead, as I understand it, to worse impacts of chronic pain. How do you intervene to stop that kind of feedback loop that can happen?
Yeah, you're right on, actually. And there is a significant, you know, the mind and the body are not separate. They are connected and they very much influence each other. And so we can do things, and we work with Dr. Trevino here. So like if she identifies somebody who's at risk for chronic pain, we can work with them to kind of talk about, okay, you have this pain that you're experiencing. When you're experiencing pain, how do you respond to that pain? So, because pain can also make people feel as if they have a lack of sense of control over what's happening to their body. And so we work with them to find different coping strategies to help. It's not going to alleviate their pain, but it's going to help decrease the added burden that the pain can have when we are also feeling as though we're feeling frustrated by the pain or feeling down about the pain. And so we monitor not just psychological symptoms that can occur post-injury, but also how their pain is doing and how they're responding to the pain and what triggers might be exacerbating their pain that we can maybe focus on and treat from a psychological and cognitive behavioral therapy standpoint.
We're talking about efforts to help gunshot victims in the days, weeks, and months following gun violence. Terry Darun-Cassini and Colleen Trevino are with us from the Medical College of Wisconsin. They're part of the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic at Frederick Hospital. Colleen, one goal, I find this really interesting, isn't just to treat that patient for the gunshot wound they've already had, but to interrupt a future potential cycle of violence. Can you talk about the violence interruption program that's part of this whole deal?
It's probably the most interesting change that we have been able to experience as clinicians in the last 5 years. The connection that we have with the 414 Life team has provided us with credible messengers to our patients and breaks down the barriers that have been put up over the years with the trust in healthcare. And having that connection with them and our patients has really been able to get us to be able to help our patients even more with all of the biopsychosocial needs that they have. And I'll have Dr. Darun-Cassini talk a little bit more about the program as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, our violence interruption team is amazing. They are on the hospital side where they respond when a patient comes to our medical center. Mostly our patients that are under the age of 35, because we know there's significant risk for future firearm violence mortality in individuals that have experienced a non-fatal shooting within that age group. And so our social workers, usually in the emergency department, will page out to our violence interrupters, which those at the hospital, we call them hospital responders. And then they talk about non-retaliation. They talk about safe housing and if they're safe to leave the hospital. They talk about the social circumstances around the shooting and helping them to find non-violent ways to move forward and also safe ways to move forward after that injury. And then from there, they work on connecting patients with resources. So they work with our social worker, who's a part of our team, to make sure that they have the resources that they need. We try to get them to safe housing if it's not safe for them to return home and beyond. So they really identify all of the resources based on those psychosocial needs that, that our patients may need to help them navigate the difficult social situations that may be a part of and the background related to the violence.
And Terry, staying with the social side of things, we hear about social determinants of health a lot these days, including access to healthcare in the first place. What kind of things do you do to make sure people stay connected to the healthcare they're going to need, the physical, the mental, the emotional support they need after surviving that gunshot wound?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that we're really proud of is that since establishing this clinic, our no-show rate for the firearm violence patients seen in our medical center after their discharge from the hospital for their first clinic visit went from 40% no-show rate down to 12% no-show rate with this new clinic. So we know that in a group of individuals that are highly marginalized group of individuals, often don't even have a strong connection with a primary care provider, and who are at risk for long-term significant health disparities, it is so critical for us to establish good relationships with this patient population to try to get them connected with the medical providers they need long-term in order to try to mitigate their risk of negative health outcomes down the road. And so some of the things we do, for example, is we collaborate with Laura Hawks, who's a physician here at MCW and Freidart Health. And she is trauma-informed in her care as a primary care internal medicine doc. And so if we have patients that don't have primary care, for example, we can make direct referral to Laura Hawks and her team to try to get patients connected with those services. One of the other great things that I think is just phenomenal about this clinic is that our team can identify when, let's say, a patient is in need of physical therapy. Our physical therapist just today identified the need of a patient. He's having some dizziness after being shot, having facial injuries as a result of the shooting. And so she is actually getting him connected with vestibular therapy, for example, where that wouldn't have happened before. And so we're making connections for patients and helping to educate them on why it's so important, because all of these things are going to get them back to hopefully where they were before the shooting occurred. We also have a new part of our clinic called the post-discharge care team, and it's a nurse navigator and our social worker, and they meet with patients before they leave the hospital and then meet with them again while they're in clinic. And so if patients have questions about, I wasn't sure, or I can't remember where I need to go, or why do I need to go to this medical follow-up appointment? What is it going to do for me? They have a direct line to those individuals to ask those questions. Because, you know, for us, this is our day-to-day, but for most people, it's not normal to be in the hospital, to navigate a hospital system. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. And they're really there to help patients navigate the system to get the care that they need.
Colleen, the two of you and some of your colleagues co-wrote a paper that came out a couple months back. If I'm reading it correctly, the story we're talking about here, the conclusion is it's mostly a success story. Can you talk about some of the wins, the successes you've had in the years this has been running?
All of the things that Dr. Drunz-Cassini has talked about is the connections. It has really transformed the care that is provided to this marginalized patient population. And we are able to get mainly these young men, young Black men, back to their baseline and be able to get back to work and take care of their families and be in a safe housing situation. And so when I look back at my 20 plus year career, back in the day, I wasn't able to ask about many of these things because I had no resources to resolve some of these problems. But we continue to make additional collaborations. We have in the works a medical legal collaboration that we are going to also help put together some connections for additional legal assistance. And then also JobWorks MKE collaboration, a group in the city that can help our patients identify other opportunities for work, especially if they've become injured and disabled because of their injury and can no longer do the work that they had done before. I feel like the success is our patients, and we get to see all of their needs addressed so that they can become whole again.
Terry, at the outset, Colleen said this is a unique program in Milwaukee. Sounds like it shouldn't be unique. Are you preaching the gospel of this approach to gunshot wounds to your colleagues around the country?
Absolutely. Actually, Colleen and I get consulted quite often from other medical centers that are level one trauma centers with high rates of firearm violence patients across, we get consulted all the time. Actually, last week I was in Nashville, Tennessee, presenting on how to provide and develop a mental health care program for trauma survivors in trauma centers. And I can't tell you how many people knew about our clinic and really wanted to talk about that. And so that's part of why, as clinical scientists, we publish papers, we present at conferences, because we want to demonstrate the model that we've developed here, and then also try to support with evidence other clinicians to use the evidence that we have to make a case to their medical systems about why a clinic like this is so important and how it gets established. Oftentimes, though, you know, the nitty-gritty details about how to logistically set up a clinic like this aren't in those research papers. And so that's when Colleen and I jump on the phone or Zoom or meet with colleagues at conferences nationally to try to help them navigate any obstacles that they may have and talk through logistically how we were able to set up this clinic.
Colleen, what are your hopes for the future of the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic? What are some next steps?
We are really looking at our patients longitudinally and determining if some of the interventions that we're doing related to our post-discharge care team and all of the resources that we provide are actually making a difference long-term. So right now we are doing a study to look at the long-term quality of life outcomes, such as depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and chronic pain and chronic disability, and measuring those over the next 6 months. And so we can see if what we're doing in this clinic is really making that difference over the long term.
We'll leave it there. Colleen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Terry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Colleen Trevino is director of the Fradert and Medical College of Wisconsin Trauma Quality of Life Clinic in Milwaukee. And Terry Darun Cassini is a psychologist and director of the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. For disclosure, Fradert and the Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR. Stick around. There's more to come on WPR News.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Green Lake Park in northern Wisconsin was shut down after federal budget cuts, but now it's back and open to visitors. We meet two of the community members who helped bring the beloved park back to life. That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Ahead of Memorial Day, here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about losing a loved one during wartime.
For those who have fought and died in the U.S. Armed Forces, they leave with their families the weight of their sacrifice. Holly Higgins of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, lost her son Daniel Johnson while he served in the Air Force in Afghanistan. Higgins talks about dealing with her loss with her other son, Eric Johnson, a specialist in the U.S. Army National Guard. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
My name is Eric Johnson. I am 30 years old. I am in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. I am here with my mother, Holly Higgins.
Holly Higgins. I'm 64 years old here in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, with my son, Eric. What triggered you to want to go into the service to begin with?
One of my older brothers out of four, Dan, was in the Air Force, and he had been for 2, maybe 3 years. He joined when I was still in high school, and I remember seeing a change in him in the way that he treated me as an older brother. I could tell that the military definitely impacted the way that he treated others, and I kind of wanted that for myself. In the transition of me making the decision to actually join, we found out that Dan was killed overseas. It wasn't an easy decision, but I think through his sacrifice, he still convinced me that what he stood for in regards to freedom and wanting to help others in the world, that it was worth it.
You know, it took me back. Hearing you talking about it makes me think back to when he first told me he was going to go into the Air Force and how I cried for many weeks. I was more afraid of of him being hurt emotionally by war and combat. I didn't let myself even think that he could be physically or that he would die. And I remember him saying to me, you know, Mom, I'm going over there to save lives, not to take them. I don't even know how to put it, but I think knowing how important everything had become to you with what you were doing as an adult in your life, I was impressed with your courage, with your ability to choose to do what was right for you. And it was impressive. I'll always be afraid for you and your other brothers. You know, I mean, before Dan's death, I didn't think anything would ever happen to you guys. I just didn't think it could be possible. It wasn't going to happen to us, you know. Now I know that it can. And so there'll always be that. But I don't let that affect what I say to you or my trust and belief and hopes and pride in the choices that you make. I think you probably know about the mug he gave me and what that's come to represent for me with the poppies on it.
Yeah.
It's brought my spirit the ability to accept that this was Dan's destiny. That he found that mug in Scotland when he was 16 and brought it home for me. And at that point, no military discussion had ever been brought up. At the time, I didn't even notice that they were poppies. And he didn't know any, I don't think he knew what that would even mean. And it wasn't until 7 years after he was killed that I realized those were poppies on that mug. And knowing that poppies represent the death on the battlefield has brought me just a peace in my soul. I mean, I'll never not be brokenhearted and wounded over Dan's death. I'll never not miss him, and I'll never feel like it was okay that it happened. But I know in my spirit that somehow he it was his destiny. It was his path.
That was Holly Higgins and Eric Johnson of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
Tomorrow, a much-loved community park in Mountain, Wisconsin, will reopen for the first time in almost 10 years.
Located in northern Wisconsin, in the midst of national forest land, Green Lake Park closed down under a money-saving plan from the U.S. Forest Service.
When it closed, the Forest Service didn't connect the dots that Green Lake Park was home to a building on the Historic Register, a shelter that the Mountain Historical Society is in charge of upkeep and preservation for.
In 2019, the Forest Service even planned to remove the structure in its proposed five-year strategy as a means of saving money. Residents of Mountain, population 289, they weren't going to let that happen.
Now we meet two of the people who successfully led the effort to save the park and its historic structure. Brenda Carey Milkey is a town board supervisor and president of the Mountain Historical Society, and Barb Palmer grew up in Mountain and lives there now. Barb, welcome to the show.
You're welcome.
And Brenda, thanks a lot for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for calling.
Brenda, take us back to 2015. You get this news from the Forest Service that they're going to close Green Lake Park. How did that hit you? How did that feel?
Well, it hit the community really hard. Green Lake Park is an 80-plus-year-old park that's been in the Mountain community since before the Civilian Conservation Corps was established. Back in the late 1920s.
And Barb, a lot of people in the community have personal ties, even family ties, and I understand you've got a connection with the park and the shelter there.
Well, since I grew up in Mountain, my family, that was our swimming hole there, our swimming lake. So anytime our family was going swimming, we'd go to Green Lake. And I'm a We lived about 2 miles away, so I would walk there in the afternoon, sometimes be picked up, but more often walk back, because stay-at-home moms did not have cars in those days.
Brenda, a big part of this story is the shelter, a Civilian Conservation Corps-era pavilion. Can you tell us about that and the role it plays at the park?
Okay. The Civilian Conservation Corps built the pavilion as a picnic shelter back in the late 1930s, 1937. And it was to be a warming place, because there's a beautiful stone hearth in it. It was a warming place and shelter for the men who were working with the Civilian Conservation Corps to have a place to stay, to be able to go there and eat with their families and be with their children. That is entrenched deep in our community. Back in the late 1990s, U.S. Forest Service has placed it on the National Registry of Historic Places because it's culturally significant to our community. It's a part of our heritage and our roots. In 2015, when the park got closed, it was said that it was closed because of the federal budget cuts and they were not going to reopen. When Mountain Historical Society got involved in 2020, we basically pushed the understanding forward and the information that that pavilion was on the National Registry of Historic Places, and we were charged by the Secretary of the Interior to protect and preserve that park. And we had to have access to it, regardless of the budget cuts. With the Forest Service's realization that it was on the National Registry of Historic Places, it took us some time, but they literally rewrote the federal policy on the closing of these parks to allow not-for-profits like Mountain Historical Society to enter into an intergovernmental agreement with U.S. Forest Services. So right now we have a 25-year lease. We signed that in September of 2023 and renewable in 25 years to restore, protect, and preserve that park for the community. And we're really excited. We didn't think we'd get here, but we have.
Now, I got to ask, Brenda, I think a lot of people might have taken that news back, 9 years ago and said, well, that's a bummer. It's too bad, but it's going away. What made you say, no, let's find a way to keep this cherished park open?
Barb. Barb came to me, and I was elected president of Mountain Historical Society. And she said, Brenda, we've got to get that park open. We have to have access to that pavilion. So that put it in motion. And then we just did what we had to do. We made the contacts we needed to make. I mean, there was a group of people prior to Mountain Historical Society's involvement who tried to get it opened, or reopened rather, and they were shot down. They were told, absolutely not. That park is never reopening. We're not going to enter into any agreement with anybody on it. Until Mountain Historical Society brought forward, hey, that shelter's on the National Registry of Historic Places, and we have to have access to it.
Persistence on Brenda's part is what made it happen.
Thank you.
Barb, what did you think when you heard the news that after all this time, the park, Green Lake Park, was going to reopen?
I'm very excited about it. It has a lot of memories for me growing up in Mountain, and a lot of memories for people that have used the park in the past.
It's just nice. It's picturesque. It sits on a beautiful, clean lake that has not been polluted, minimal phosphates. It's a no-wake lake. It's got a sandy beach, sandy waters. It's just beautiful.
And all the restoration that they did made it even better. It really is beautiful how it's evolved into what it is now.
We're talking to Brenda Carey-Milkey and Barb Palmer of Mountain, Wisconsin, about the long-awaited reopening of Green Lake Park there after it looked like it was going to go away. Brenda, I understand a lot of volunteer labor has gone into getting the park ready to reopen and will go into it to maintain. Can you talk about how the community's come together and volunteered there?
So we decided that Saturday was going to be community park cleanup day. It was felt that we as a community are going to need to come together to keep and maintain this park. And on our opening Saturday, which was in March, and thank heaven we had a really good mild winter up here, we were able to get in early and work most every Saturday. The first day we had 48 volunteers. People showed up with trucks, trailers, chainsaws, front loaders, bobcats, rakes, shovels, whatever they could do, they brought to help. We are at approximately $24,000 in in-kind contributions and labor. I don't know how we could have afforded to have this park cleaned up the way we did without the members of the community coming forward and stepping up.
Barb, it sounds like Mountain is a pretty cool place if people are willing to step up and volunteer like this. Can you just tell us a little bit about a mountain and what makes you love it and makes you stick around and live there?
It's a beautiful community in the national forest with a lot of lakes, a lot of people coming in and cabins. I grew up here, left for 40 years to make a living, and we retired back here in 1998. So it draws everyone back who has been here.
Right. That's a good way of putting it. People come back home.
Brenda, we are knocking on the door of a grand reopening. Tell us a little bit about the opening day festivities coming up.
Well, absolutely. It's going to be May 25th at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's Memorial Day weekend. We are going to be having an opening with U.S. Forest Services and a keynote speaker. And we have a representative who has been with the State Historical Society who will also be coming here from southern Wisconsin to take part in the opening. We're going to have activities for the kids. We've had some great grants provided. We have a grant writer, and we have grants through the Lumberjack Council, through Wisconsin Public Services Greater Foundation, to the Green Bay Foundation. And we're just really excited moving forward.
Barb, you said you grew up swimming in Green Lake. Are you looking forward later in the summer as it warms up to seeing a next generation of swimmers get out there?
I will make sure the next generation uses that lake, and I'll get in there with them just to say 85 years of swimming in that lake.
And Barb, are you going to be there for opening day?
I am going to be there, yes. Of course.
And I think the community is going to show up too.
Fantastic. Brenda, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for helping us get the word out.
And Barb, thanks for sharing the story.
Thank you.
Brenda Carey Milkey is president of the Mountain Historical Society, and Barb Palmer was born and raised in Mountain. We talked about the three-acre Green Lake Park's reopening after nearly a decade of closure and how the residents of Mountain worked together to bring the park back to life. As we heard, the park's grand reopening is scheduled for tomorrow morning.
Hey, Rob, you know, it's a great time of year to go out for walks and hikes.
Definitely. Maybe in a place like Green Lake Park.
There you go. And coming up next week, we will meet a master naturalist who says we should do some slow botany where we take the time to appreciate the flowers and other plants that we see.
That is a good lesson for me. I tend to be a fast walker and I can miss out on a lot of the cool stuff I'm walking right past.
And we want to hear from you. Do you take time to stop and, as they say, smell the flowers or identify the flowers? Maybe you appreciate all those towering trees overhead when you're out for a walk or a hike.
And do you have a favorite place to commune with nature, see some great plant life? Call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.